Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The blunt budget cudgel known as sequestration became reality last week. Congress and the White House failed to come up with a plan to avert across-the-board federal spending cuts. Another budget deadline is fast approaching. Without an agreement by the end of March, the government will be forced to shut down. Joining me to talk about these seemingly endless budget crises, Kevin Hassett of the American Enterprise Institute, Jared Bernstein of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, and Jim Tankersley of the Washington Post. I hope you'll join our conversation. Lend your voice to the discussion. Call us on 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning to all of you. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Diane.
Good morning.
Good to have you here. Let me start with you, Jared. Talk about the timeline for really implementing these cuts.
Well, the timeline began, I think it was midnight, March 1st, $85 billion cuts over the course of what's called the fiscal year, which we make this very confusing in Washington. That goes through the end of September. What we talk about are the negative outlays, that is the actual decline in spending over the course of the year, the calendar year. The full year is about $66 billion. Some of those cuts have actually begun already, but it's going to be a rolling and a cumulative kind of process. I think the furloughs will come later if this sticks. But right away, for example, the unemployment insurance benefits of people on long-term unemployment insurance have come down. There's been the beginning of some furloughs at some contractors, some cuts along the way. So it will be a rolling cumulative impact expected ultimately to cut about 0.5% off of GDP growth this year and as many as 700,000 jobs.
Kevin Hassett, who is most likely to feel these cuts?
Gosh, I think that if we lose 0.5% of GDP this year because of these cuts, and I think that Jared's assessment is ballpark the right number. I think there's probably some dispute of whether it's 0.3 or 0.6, but it's in there. Then the people who will feel it most will be probably the long-term unemployed who are currently without a job, because that growth will make it much less likely that our economy will create jobs. It'll be harder for people to find jobs. And so, you know, the extreme suffering that, as you know, I've written a lot about of these long-term unemployed is likely going to be worse this year because of this and because also of the big tax increase at the turn of the year, which is about twice as big as the spending cut that we're talking about.
Jim Tankersley, you agree?
I agree. I think that what we've seen now for years is this lack of focus on job creation has perpetuated this problem with the long-term unemployed. And the worry is that the longer that this lasts, the longer we go with slow growth, with high unemployment and high long-term unemployment, the more the possibility rises that we could have people who become almost permanently unemployable. Their skills deteriorate, and they just have a much, much harder time finding a job.
Jim, over the weekend, we heard lots of talk about whose fault all this is, who did or did not do what was needed. What's needed now?
Well, that's a broad question, and I think that the answer is what's needed now is something to boost the economy and help reduce the deficit over long term via growth. And what we managed to get through sequestration is one of the least optimal ways of doing that by any economist's reckoning. If you're a Keynesian economist who believes that you should be spending a lot more money in the government right now, you didn't get that. You're pulling back. If you're an economist who believes that businesses aren't feeling confident because of the path of fiscal policy in the United States, we didn't really get that either, because we haven't touched the big drivers of long-term deficits, which are healthcare costs, with this bill. So what would be nice would be something to address either of those concerns in a way that would make at least some group of economists think that we're on a higher growth path.
Kevin, what would make sense now?
Sure. You know, and in fact, I think that we can focus on the negative, and there's a lot of negative, but I think that you could also focus a little bit on the positive, which is that there's bipartisan agreement that we need to have some kind of big fiscal adjustment that phases in, you know, fixes to our entitlement programs and our tax code over time in a way that creates a foundation for job creation and long-term growth and doesn't create a big negative stimulus this year. I think that if you look at the way that they structured the sequestration, it really was designed to be kind of a credible commitment to that fiscal adjustment, because the sequestration was designed to really be harsh, as was the sort of fiscal cliff that came at the end of the year. They were designed to be harsh as a commitment from both parties that we're going to finally be adults and get together and address our problems. In fact, there are even little nuances that haven't been covered. So, for example, if you go back to Graham Rudman, where they invented sequestration, they had what Phil Graham likes to call lifeboats in the legislation, that the sequestration itself was kind of harsh. But in the original design of sequestration, either the Speaker of the House or the Majority Leader could fast-track a bill to the Senate and get a vote right away if he had a better way to get the same amount of reduction. But they removed the lifeboats for this one, again, because they were trying to force action. So they haven't made the action yet, and so we should criticize them for that. But I do think that there's hope, because they both recognized in the beginning that we need to make a credible commitment to fix things, and the sequestration was designed to do that, and then it failed. But I tend to focus on the positive with that.
Jared, let me ask you, Kevin's talking about entitlements. Hasn't President Obama acknowledged that he is willing to make cuts in entitlements?
Yeah, this is very important. And in fact, he's actually, with the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, he's actually made some big cuts in Medicare's spending growth over the next decade. And interestingly, in the campaign, I remember Mitt Romney saying two things. He said, the president won't tackle entitlements, and the president just cut your Medicare. They, of course, can't both be true. So there were significant cuts in the growth rates of Medicare in the Affordable Care Act, but the president has since put forth in his plan, he keeps talking about, I do have a compromise plan here that involves both revenue increases and spending cuts, and part of those spending cuts are cuts both to Social Security and Medicare. So that is true.
Jim, have you heard that expressed publicly and clearly?
That the president has a plan? My colleague...
No, the president is willing to make cuts to Medicare and Social Security.
So my colleague Ezra Klein had a very interesting piece over the weekend talking about this, where he basically said, look, if you look on the president's website, on the White House website, you see the president is offering a change to Social Security called a change CPI, which would slow the growth of Social Security benefits
over
time.
Do Republicans want that?
Well, yes, they do. And Ezra's point in his column was they might not know this because they keep calling on him to say this. However, he also had a follow-up to the column over the weekend where, when he brought this to the attention of some Republican consultants on Twitter, they then said, well, we don't believe he's serious about that, or we don't believe that's enough, or we don't believe this is credible. So I think we have a case where the parties just don't trust each other on this, and the Republicans do not trust the president on what he's talking about.
So the president has made it clear, at least in his mind, that he's willing to make those cuts, and Republicans are saying we don't believe him. Kevin.
I think that that might be right. I think that there's a question of what's going on with the cuts, and then there's a question of additional revenues right now. And the Republicans voted to have a very large tax increase at the end of the year. If you look at the CBO's current 10-year outlook that includes those tax hikes, then revenue to GDP at the end of the 10-year period is going to be about 2 percentage points higher than its 40-year average. So there's a lot more revenue coming in.
Too far down in the weeds.
No, that's not weeds, because the point is the Republicans just passed a big tax hike that makes it so that tax revenue is actually coming in at a very high percentage of GDP by historic precedents. The president is saying, I'll do some of this other stuff that you like, but only if you give me even more revenues, and that's why we're hung up right now.
I think that's basically misleading in the following sense. Republicans like to start their clock, counting what's gone on in terms of fiscal policy, with the tax increase that very much did occur, as Kevin said, in January of this year. Well, if you go back to the Budget Control Act, which was the big fiscal legislation that set all this craziness up back in 2011, the parties agreed to over $1.5 trillion in spending cuts over the next 10 years. So we've had $1.5 trillion in spending cuts, $600 billion in tax increases. When you present it as Kevin just did, it sounds like all we've done is increase taxes. But in fact, we've cut spending far more than that.
Do you agree with that, Jim Tankersley?
I think the math is pretty clear that we have done both spending cuts and revenue increases. I think the question here,
but do you agree with the numbers I cited, that we've done considerably more on the spending cuts than the tax increases?
I think it is clear that there have been higher over a 10-year period spending cuts than tax increases.
Right.
Now, however, I would also say this. What we haven't seen in the last 2 or 3 years are a paired set of policies to try to really produce more growth, because that is the third part of this equation that we just aren't talking about.
I agree with
which
that.
Which is, how do we get the economy growing faster, creating more jobs, putting those long-term unemployed people back to work, and bringing down our deficit, because that's what higher growth will do for the budget standpoint.
It's as if we're
but,
so...
Hold on
sorry,
a minute. But Kevin and Jared have both said that sequestration is really going to hurt the long-term unemployed more than any other sector of the population. If that's the case, then what more do they want to see sequestration come to an end? President says he's willing to give on Social Security. He's willing to give on Medicare. I'm baffled, and I have the feeling that many of our listeners are baffled as well. Going to take a short break here. When we come back, we'll hear more explanations about what's behind all of this. Welcome back. We're talking about what has become an overused but necessary word in today's vocabulary, sequestration, and its impact. Here with me in the studio, Jim Tankersley of the Washington Post, Jared Bernstein of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, Kevin Hassett, Director of Economic Policy Studies at the American Enterprise Institute. Jim Tankersley, just before the break, you were talking about what the president has offered, but what he's asking for, the Republicans do not want to give.
Right. I think it's really important to think of what the president is putting on the table versus what the Republicans want in the following terms. He is putting on the table things, changes to entitlement programs, such as reduction in Medicare spending and a change in reduction in Social Security benefits over time that they would like, but only in the context of, I will do this if you agree to raise taxes by closing loopholes and limiting deductions for rich people.
What loopholes?
Right. Well, he hasn't really specified all of that, but essentially, if you agree to the goal that we're going to raise more tax revenue by closing loopholes and reducing deductions for wealthier people, then I will put these things on the table. They the Republican leaders are saying that's not a serious offer because we're not going to raise revenues. So this is the problem. The revenues are the big hang-up between the two parties right now.
And, Kevin, this is a basic philosophical difference.
Right. And I think that Jim nailed it, and it can help clarify these issues for all of us to think about it as maybe being a three-step process that ultimately when this all works out, hopefully favorably, then we're going to see that three steps happened, I believe. The first is the tax increase that just occurred. The second step is they're going to work out some change to spending so that the sequestration cuts are backloaded a little bit more or maybe a little bit larger off in the future, a little bit smaller today. And then the third step is going to be there's a tax reform where the admissions ticket for tax reform that Republicans have to be willing to pay is that they are willing to accept more revenue. The problem is that the Republican President Obama is trying to make the second and third step happen at once. The Republicans just really broke their vow to increase, you know, not to increase taxes at the turn of the year. They want this to be about spending only, and then have a next step of tax reform. And Mr. Camp, the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, is having hearings on this and so on. And then at that point, my guess is that revenue would be on the table again because tax reform, the Republicans think that the benefits of that are really large. But I think that combining the tax cut, I mean, the tax increase with the spending change right now is kind of fast forwarding to the third step before they finish the second. And that's why we're sort of hung up right now.
Jared, we're hung up on this idea that the tax increases in January should be part of the negotiations now. You see that differently.
Yeah, I do see that differently. And by the way, while Kevin's three steps sound extremely reasonable, and if he and I were sitting in a room together, I'll bet we could implement those three steps. That's not
I'm
at all.
I'm always reasonable, Jared.
Yeah. The problem is you're way far away from where the Republican Party leaders are, who have been incredibly adamant, Jim will back me up on this, have been incredibly adamant about no more revenue. So their third step of getting to new revenues has been something they have consistently said no on. Look, in January, there was this increase of $600 billion in taxes over the next 10 years, falling on largely on families at the very top of the income scale, above $400,000. Wow. Now, the president won an election based largely on that policy, so that shouldn't have been a surprise to anyone. As I mentioned earlier, we've cut a lot more on the spending side than we've increased on the tax side. What the president is saying now is that we need a balanced deal. We are actually not that far from achieving a sustainable path in our budget.
We're quite close.
And this isn't going to sound quite close. We're $1.5 trillion over 10 years away from stabilizing the growth of the debt as a share of the economy, which is the first order goal of fiscal rectitude. That's actually not that heavy a lift if you look over history with a functional Congress, but that's what we're lacking. You only can get there with a balanced deal. You can't cut your way there just on spending side alone without deeply compromising key government functions.
How do you think people across the country are reacting to this discussion, Jim?
It's interesting. I talk to a lot of folks across the country. The first thing that everyone says is, why can't people in Washington just get together and solve this? Why can't, if they're close, if they're moderately close, even if they're far apart, why can't the president and the Speaker of the House and the Senate Majority Leader sit down and hammer out a deal the way that people like to think they remember Washington hammering out deals? The second thing, though, is a little bit of exasperation, especially among conservatives. There's this exasperation of, look, we elected these guys in 2010 to cut spending, and we don't feel like they have cut spending nearly as much as we wanted to. And that, I think, very much explains why the sequester went into effect, that conservatives started feeling real pressure from their base to let the cuts take effect, regardless of what they did to the military, which was supposed to be the forcing agent on Republicans. Their pressure came from the side that said, spending's out of control, we need to bring it down, do something. You've got something that's going to happen, let it happen.
So even conservatives, as they support the military and don't want to see cuts to the military, were willing to let sequestration happen with these across the board cuts to the military.
Right at this moment, that's right. And so I think that there are a lot of conservatives that are very unhappy about the military cuts. And I think that was part of the original calculation, was that the sequestration would kind of divide the party because the military folks would say, oh, I just can't handle that. In fact, we've even seen this notion that an aircraft carrier is not going to be in the Gulf. It's a serious issue because it takes about a month to get it there, right? And so there are serious costs now being borne by our defenses because we are unable to make a deal.
Okay. So to what extent are Republicans divided at this point, Jim?
I think they are feeling pretty solidly united on the question of let's cut spending. I think they are divided maybe on the question of how to alleviate some of the military burden and whether to do that in the next thing that's going to happen, which is the continuing resolution to fund the government over the next few months, which brings me to a point that I'd like to make. The other thing you hear talking to people throughout the country, real people, economists who I only sometimes call real people, is this idea—
I resemble that.
Right.
We're surreal people.
Right. Is this idea that that— having a budget fight every 2 or 3 months in Washington is really, really bad for sort of the nation's economic psychology. People are getting really sick of it. But we're going to keep doing that until either they come up with a big plan or they just sort of declare that it's going to be all-out war in the next election and we'll solve it then.
It's so discouraging to hear this kind of, we're not going to budge. I wonder who's going to bear the burden of this.
Yeah, that is the one of the important questions right now. But let me stop before and just focus on your first sentiment, which you've been expressing throughout the show, and which I very much share, which is bewilderment, bafflement, disgust. And Jim was talking about that outside of the Beltway. The idea that, you know, in my day job as an economist talking about this, I'm constantly catching myself and saying, boy, I'm just sort of rationally ticking through the moving parts of what is just crazy. The idea that somehow this kind of damage to an economy that's already too wobbly, as far as I'm concerned, is the new normal, is nothing more than political malfunction and political malpractice by our policymakers. And I do believe that Americans need to stand up and tell their representatives that. And that gets to the answer to your question. If, in fact, the difficulties associated with sequestration are what I think they will be, not yet, but as furloughs come online, as people start to experience delays in the airport, as food production slows down, as so many civilian military employees are furloughed, then I do think that people will start to recognize just how damaging that is, because there's this myth in too many people's head that every dollar spent is a dollar wasted when it's the government spending. That's just not true.
But hold on a minute. Has President Obama done everything he could to help the American people understand what he is willing to give in this deal? Kevin?
I don't think he has. I certainly follow it closely, and I'm puzzled by it. I know Jared is close to them and probably knows the best.
But I
think, though, also that and it's natural in our democracy to do this, that we have to remember that this thing could be solved with President Obama just signing at the end. So it's not just him. If the Senate Democrats and Republicans can come together and come to some kind of reasonable agreement, then, you know, they could talk to Mr. Boehner and they could pass a bill and send it up to the White House. So if people are mad at President Obama and the Republican Party, then they don't even have to deal with him. They could still solve this. And so I think that President Obama has been kind of playing it both ways, that on the one hand, he wants to perhaps make space for the moderates in the Senate to come together. On the other hand, he wants to be a leader. And I don't think he's really found his voice in that space.
Jim,
and that's why we're confused.
Would you agree?
I think it's the folks who think that the president can do this all on his own are wrong. The folks who think that the president is powerless in this to effect change are also wrong. And I would agree with the sentiment that Kevin said and that Jared echoed, that there is probably a lot more everyone in Washington could be doing right now to actually talk to each other and try to make a deal. I actually think it probably starts in the Senate. The Senate is the place where sort of because of the filibuster and the way it's been used lately and because of all sorts of electoral sort of hitches because of who's up in 2 years, it's sort of a constantly – there's not a lot of tough votes. There's not a lot of There hasn't been a budget passed in years. It's hard to have negotiation between the House and the Senate, as Kevin was just suggesting, if the Senate's not passing anything.
Mm-hmm. But let me be clear. I agree only up to a point in the following sense. The president said something important the other day. He's talking about Jedi mind melding. I can't force the Congress to agree that new tax revenues have to be part of the deal. So as long as they're refusing to agree to what I would consider a balanced plan, which involves spending cuts, including entitlements, as you yourself have been stressing, Diane, spending cuts and revenue increases, which I would call balance and which I think most Americans would recognize as balance, as long as they're refusing to accept that, it is hard to see any way forward. And Jim's right. The president can't make them compromise.
He also said, I'm not a dictator.
Right.
The thing I would like to understand is, what are the loopholes that the president is talking about that he wants to see Republicans agree to? It strikes me that the public needs to understand what those loopholes are. Specifically, do you have any idea, Jim?
I think that not specific loopholes, but I think that one thing that the president's has indicated a real willingness toward, and you can look at it a bunch of different ways, whether it was the Buffett rule that he proposed last year, or whether it was sort of the White House kind of coming out in favor of limiting deductions for rich people. So basically, it doesn't matter what deductions you take, you can only take a certain amount of them and then they're capped. Now, the effect of that would be, especially if you carved out an exemption for charitable giving, the effect of that would be to limit the mortgage interest deduction, health insurance.
On high-end people.
So that would be the effect. And that's – my guess is if there's a compromise to be had here, that's a much easier compromise to make than targeting specific deductions which have very limited interest groups behind them.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Kevin Hassett, where does incoming Secretary of Defense Hagel stand on cuts to defense programs?
You know, I've not seen him speak about it. I know that former Secretary Panetta was adamantly opposed to them, and they really are causing the Defense Department a lot of grief. I think that something will likely be done about that at some point.
Defense spending.
Right, because don't forget that this is another thing, and it's a problem that we in Washington have that I know that our listeners outside of Washington are very aware of, which is that we tend to think that each bill, each debate that we're having is the penultimate one. But you could, for example, let sequestration happen and then think of the three or four things, like Jared mentioned, the unemployment insurance or the defense spending. You could have a standalone bill to send an aircraft carrier to the Gulf. You could start passing fixes to the sequestration one bill at a time. And so that's a possibility as we look forward to how this might work itself out.
But, you know, as historians look at this very period, say 20, 30, 50 years hence, what do you think they're going to see and wonder about, Jared?
I just think it's quite simple. I think they're going to look back and try and be very scratching their heads very hard, trying to figure out why were policymakers making things worse? What happened in our process? And I think it's very much a political problem, such that the federal government lost its ability to accurately diagnose what's wrong and to prescribe fixes. Because, you can talk about all the steps we could take if compromise were an option to fix this. There are ones. Our system has the flexibility to do that. But the political gridlock, and I've been around for a long time and I've talked to a lot of other old timers, we've never seen this level of dysfunction. And I think historians will look back at this period and say, remarkable how upside down policymaking became.
Kevin.
Yeah, I think Jared's right. And I think that what historians might say is that we of the nation have lost what you, Diane, in particular, have oodles of, which is just grace. We don't have grace. We need to let the other guy have a win now and then. We need to not feel like that we have to put a knife to everybody's throat on every single bill. And I wonder why we've lost the grace. But I know that if I look back at the early Clinton years before it blew up, or if I look at Herbert Walker Bush's administration or Ronald Reagan's administration, there were times when the president would step out and just say to members of his party, hey, guys, you don't like it, but do it. Yeah. Because these guys have a point. And it's just been a long time. We've had two presidents that haven't been able to do that for some reason. And I'm sure I don't want to place blame on President Obama, but we've wandered into this place that just needs more grace.
Yeah.
Sorry.
But we have a more polarized Congress. The vote ratings are clear. We've come to a point in our history where there is no single Democrat who is more conservative than a single Republican in the House of Representatives or in the Senate. That's totally different than it used to be. It used to be these regional variations with the parties. You had liberal Republicans from the Northeast, conservative Democrats from the South. The sorting that has happened along partisan lines has affected this, and we should be wary of that. I mean, we have right now, parties that are as responsive or more responsive to their base voters, they're more worried about a primary challenge than they are about losing a general election. And when that happens, you see the sort of polarization that leads to difficult negotiating outcomes.
So what happens next?
I think what happens next is a lot more fighting and best case scenario, maybe some small bore agreements to keep getting things done at the last minute, to keep the lights on in the government, to raise the debt ceiling one more time, whatever.
Unless
somebody can break through.
All right. Taking a short break here. I hope that some of our listeners will come up with an idea to break through. Short break and right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, dedicated to educating wonks to use knowledge to change the world. More at american.edu/wonk. By The Scan Foundation, committed to aging with dignity and independence at thescanfoundation.org. And by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. This is NPR.
Grammy Award-winning singer-songwriter Carole King, on her decades-long career in music, her work for women's rights and environmental advocacy. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour.
And troubled.
Talking about that baffling word, sequestration, what it means, who says what, and where it's going. First email for you, Kevin. It's from Kate, who says, I am beyond baffled by the Republicans' mantra of taxes having gone up in January. Beyond the 2% payroll hike on everyone, the only federal tax increases are to the wealthiest Americans. Correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is the wealthiest Americans saw their taxes go back to pre-Bush era levels. I, and everyone I know, do not consider this a tax increase. It's simply a repeal of a set of tax cuts that benefited the wealthy unfairly.
Okay, so Kate is correct that tax rates went back to where they were before President Bush reduced them, except that there are a few little footnotes where it's actually a little bit more than that, and in particular the Obamacare or Affordable Care Act taxes and so on will also increase taxes. But I think that the problem that Republicans have with that tax increase, or say Republican economists, I won't speak for Republican politicians, is that while wages that high-income people make are not very responsive to tax rates, the activity of small business is. And about half of small business income is affected by that top rate. And so precisely when we want people to be creating jobs, then we've increased the tax rate and reduced the take-home profit from the typical small business, about half of small business income. And so I think that that's a really bad idea. But I agree that in a big tax reform, that taxes on wages and taxes on capital income, or taxes on consumption and taxes on capital income, could address these equity concerns.
But weren't the Bush tax cuts supposed to be temporary?
The Bush tax cuts were legislated to be only 10 years because of this thing they call the Byrd rule in the Senate, that they could only pass it for 10 years without exposing it to filibuster. And so the design, in fact, one might argue that if Democrats had offered Republicans at the time what ended up happening just now as a permanent cut, then they might have accepted it. They might have accepted it because they basically dealt without Democrats when President Bush was elected.
Well, I think it's actually even a little bit worse than Kate makes it sound, and I think her email is very perceptive. The 82% of the Bush-era tax cuts are now permanent. So it's not like we got rid of the Bush tax cuts. In fact, we cemented 82% of them in permanent tax law. And by the way, folks at the very top of the income scale benefit from that because the way our tax system works, as your income grows, you're now actually facing lower tax rates than you were in the Clinton years until you get up to these very high rates at the top. And Kevin is right. There have been some other taxes on top of that. Where Kevin and I very much disagree, and I would argue that the evidence supports what I'm about to say, is that he very much overestimates the impact of these tax changes at the top, what I would call pretty marginal tax changes, on savings, on investment, on business formation. The historical record shows that, in fact, those are very insensitive. You don't see investment behavior, for example, change when you tweak the tax code like that. What you see is a lot less revenues when you cut taxes and a lot more inequality.
To Bill, I think I just lost him. Let's go to Petersburg, Michigan. Good morning, Matthew.
Hey, Diane, how are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I got a couple quick points I want to make. One is, let's face it, you guys, both sides of our government, both Dems and Republicans, are guilty for where we're at right now. I didn't cause this. You guys didn't do it, but they did, all right? And, you know, the Bible says, as you sow, so shall you reap. And we're now reaping their benefits or lack of what they've done over the last 20 years. Now, you might say, well, what'd they do? Well, let's say right now, I think if you swim far enough upstream, nobody in government's got the courage to do it. And I don't think that even the media, you guys, wouldn't want to swim far enough upstream to figure out that we made these bogus lopsided trade deals with communist China. And I'm sick and tired of knowing that a communist socialist Chinese slave is making all my stuff.
Yeah, I very much reject the ultimate analysis there from the caller. I don't think that trade deals with first of all, we have no trade deals with China, just to be clear. We've never had a bilateral or multilateral trade deal with China. We did support China's entry into the WTO, and that type of globalization is very much part of today's economy. Now, it is true that lots of workers have been hurt by increased trade. That's true. But I don't believe that has much to do with what we're talking about here.
To Charlotte, North Carolina. Good morning, Debbie.
Hi, Diane. I've been enjoying the show very much, listening to it on the way to work.
Good.
And I actually have quite a number of points, but I'm going to try to limit it, especially since I'm on my way into class.
Yes, please.
Yes. My big question is, everyone always talks about entitlement. How about subsidies? Why do we never hear about limiting subsidies, which could save the United States a lot of money? I specifically target the farm bill, and why school lunches are mixed in with aid to rich farmers.
All right. Thanks for calling. Jim Tankersley.
I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, guys, that this is something on which we've seen a lot of at least rhetorical bipartisan agreement that limiting farm subsidies, for example, would absolutely be. I believe it's in the president's plan, too. It was in his offer to avert sequestration, and it is something that a lot of Republican members of Congress have expressed a lot of sympathy with. Also, this idea of what are called tax expenditures, which are ways that we subsidize people by giving them tax breaks through the code. I think the problem with all of those, as I mentioned earlier in the show, is they have very specific constituencies around them, and it's hard to win passage of the repeal of subsidies when you have a very motivated interest group that it benefits highly from them.
All right. Here's an email from Jean in Anderson, Indiana. She says, I don't believe this is about philosophical differences at all. Republicans have never agreed to work with the president on anything, whether it be the budget or who he wants in his cabinet. Convince me it is still not about trying to make the president look bad. Kevin.
Back right after President Obama took office, I asked one of my close friends, who's one of the top young Republicans on the House Ways and Means Committee, a very bright guy. I said, so they're designing all this stuff right now. Has anyone asked you what you think ought to go in the bill? And he said, no. In fact, there's no Republican on Ways and Means Committee that has had any communication at all from Democrats. No one has called up and said, okay, we're going to give you 0.1% of this bill. What do you want it to be? There was zero. But then he added this as a joke. He said, but you know, that upsets me, but I understand we just lost an election and that's how it works sometimes. The people who are really upset are the Democrats on Ways and Means because nobody asked them either. It was a total top-down bill. The thing is that from the very, very beginning, and I think that we saw this also during the Bush administration, that there's been this absence of grace, letting the other guys have a little bit of a win, conceding that they might have an argument. And so for sure, there's a broken relationship, and pointing at President Obama and saying he's 100% responsible would be inaccurate. But it's bilaterally broken. It goes back to what Matthew said, that they are all to blame.
President Obama says that I tried to reach out to Republicans in my first term and was slapped away. And I'm just not going to come back. I think
it's just not true.
No, I know. I was there for half the first term, and a lot of that did occur. I mean, you'll recall.
Give me an example, Jared. I think, you know, I've heard this said. I hear it said from both sides. Give me a specific example where President Obama reached out.
I can give you a great example.
I'll give
you a great example. First of all, let's not forget that it was Mitch McConnell who said our first goal needs to be making sure this president doesn't get reelected.
Okay, now wait a minute. Stop right there. How do you interpret that?
He's dodging your question.
No, I have
another
answer.
I have another question, yeah. But I want to hear
right.
your
partisans
response.
Partisans are partisan in a way that we don't find attractive
okay.
as listeners and economists. And for sure, President Obama's job right now is to try to crush Republicans in the next election. He's made it clear that he
okay.
wants to, and
so
it's vice versa. They're in the bad relationship.
So here's my very tangible example. See, that was framing it, teeing it up. President Obama negotiated with Speaker Boehner before this budget deal that set up all this nonsense we're dealing with now, and they actually got pretty far. Speaker Boehner agreed to $800 billion in new tax revenues, okay? The president agreed to the kinds of cuts we were talking about earlier on entitlements. He went way outside of Democrats' comfort zone on this, but he was willing to make a deal. Speaker Boehner then came back and said, I cannot get to yes. I cannot get my conference to agree on this plan that we've just hammered out together. So the president and, in fact, John Boehner agreed on a deal. But that deal never became law because Tea Party Republicans said, no, we will not accept new revenues. The president was then pilloried by Republicans for wanting to raise taxes, wanting to cut entitlements. And so I think, you know, once you try to compromise and you can't get to yes.
All right. I want to take another call right along that line in Cincinnati, Ohio. Good morning, Niall.
And thanks for taking the call. I'm glad that the last speaker brought up the Tea Party, because as far as I can see, it's the Tea Party that is responsible for all of this mess. They came into Congress and they just said no to every single thing that the president ever proposed. They've blocked and they've filibustered, and they, I think, are responsible for destroying the fabric of the government.
Jim Tankersley, I want you to weigh in here from the perspective of reporting you've done.
I would say from the perspective of reporting that I've done that we had real problems getting Democrats and Republicans to agree on things in Congress even before the Tea Party came in. And I would give the example of right after the president was elected, when I was working for the Chicago Tribune and Los Angeles Times, I was covering climate and energy. And I covered the big push the president had for an energy bill, which passed the House and then got bogged down in the Senate, where he had a Republican partner, where Lindsey Graham was working very hard with him on that. But they could not get a critical mass of Republicans or Democrats. They could not get to the 60 votes they needed. And it comes back to the Senate needing 60 votes for everything now. And that bogged down that bill, and nothing ever came of it. So I think we would be deluding ourselves to think that the Tea Party has been the start of dysfunction in this government. There has been dysfunction in this government, as Kevin was alluding, back into the Bush years. And this is, again, I think, a real function of the polarization of America.
And Kevin, I want to ask you about the example that Jared put forward.
Well, I think it's an interesting example, first because it came right at the end of the first term, more or less, right? It was a pretty late in the Obama administration example. And it is one example where there were negotiations going on. And it might have been the first time where they're actually trying to concede that, well, I have to do something if you want it, and so on. And so that was pretty late. But you know, Bob Woodward doesn't cover it that way. My contacts on the Hill don't cover it that way. That they argue that the deal broke down because the president broke his word to them, that he said we're going to do this, and then he changed it to do that. I actually wonder, Jim, if you have a take on this as a reporter, because it's not something I wasn't in the room. Diane, you weren't in the room. We can't know exactly who's to blame on that. But I think that it's interesting, is just the one point, that Jared's, you know, prime example of collegiality is in itself in dispute, and it's not a Republican that's disputing it, but Bob Woodward, and I think that that's a metric of him not being collegial enough.
What do you think, Jim?
I certainly didn't write a book about it like Bob Woodward did, and I wasn't covering the budget negotiations at the time. I certainly think the perception has been, again, that we have a total dearth of trust between these two parties, that the president's, as Jared would say, the Democrats adamantly believe that that Boehner walked away from this, and the Republicans adamantly believe the president changed his word.
All right. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show and to Virginia Beach. Good morning, George. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Ms. Rehm. Two quick points and on point. As far as government saving money and helping people, one, let's negotiate with Big Pharma about the price of drugs to Medicare. And number two, let's decrease the age eligibility of Medicare from 65 to 60, which would have a lot of net positives in terms of cost both to the government and private business.
Steve Brill was on the program just last week talking about that very issue, that is, rather than arguing about raising the age of eligibility for Medicare, lowering it. How are Democrats reacting?
Well, first of all, let me say that I listened to that show you did with Steve Brill, and I very much commend it. It's really important. He is not a healthcare wonk,
right,
which makes it in many ways all the more interesting, because this is just a journalist who sort of looked at all these hospital bills and worked backwards to find out all the profiteering and inefficiencies in the healthcare system. And he did make the case very strongly that Medicare, by dint of its large bargaining clout, is able to get very good deals on drug prices. And in fact, if you look at the increase in healthcare spending, it's much lower in Medicare and Medicaid than it is in the private sector. It's still too quick, but it's better. And so, yes, it would be a great idea to tap those efficiencies by lowering the eligibility age for Medicare, but you'd have to then find the resources to fund that. Now, those resources, as Brill said, would be saved if you took them from the private to the public sector. That is, you'd be spending less on private health care for 60 to 65-year-olds, but you'd be spending more on Medicare. And expanding an entitlement right now kind of goes against the grain.
Kevin.
Yeah, you know, I don't want to give a knee-jerk, oh, that's a ridiculous idea, because I listen to your show almost every day, but I missed that one. I just, I haven't informed myself on what he's saying enough to have an opinion. But I think
it's a really good piece, the cover story in Time magazine last Monday. So take a good look. And, you know, all this talk, where do we go next to try to get some of this resolved? Jim.
I'm going to give the answer that I've been giving for maybe 3 years now, 2.5 years. There's a very smart, very well-respected economist named Doug Elmendorf, who's the head of the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office. And he has been saying for years that we need more juice for the economy now, coupled with a credible commitment to deficit reduction in the future, and that those two things together could unlock a lot of growth, which will bring down the deficit.
Jim Tankersley of The Washington Post, Jared Bernstein at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, Kevin Hassett of the American Enterprise Institute. Let's hope that at some point all these people can get together and do something. Thank you for being here. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations.